Welcome back to Data Decoded, an IBM podcast series dedicated to demystifying the world of data. This is the podcast for data professionals and all those who understand they are in the business of data. I'm your host, William McKnight, president of McKnight Consulting Group, and we completely exist in this world of data. A different perspective on Data Decoded today. We're going to look into something that's not necessarily what we think about as a big corporate industry. You know, it's not banking or insurance or finance or healthcare. It's sports. And I am just so delighted to be able to bring you this topic because sports is a huge part of my life. I love to view it. I love to participate in it and always thinking about it. So it's his big business, by the way. Our guest today is John Kent. He's the IBM Sports and Entertainment Program Manager, and he's going to talk to us about the trends and the impact of analytics in sports, especially the fan experience. So we are going to also get into a little fantasy football later. I do play, and our guest is going to help us out, help me out anyway. John, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Can you give us an introduction to what you do at IBM?
Sure. I'm part of what we refer to as our sports and entertainment partnership team. So I work with organizations like the Masters, the U.S. Open, which is the USTA, and Wimbledon, and most recently, kind of ESPN. And we really work with those organizations kind of on multi fronts. But the core part of what I do is sort of the fan experience. So how can we bring our capabilities to bear to help these organizations, put forth the best tournament in terms of, their digital experience. And I've been in this world for about 20 years.
Okay. Well, I don't get to work in what I love, sports, that is. But can you confirm for us that actually working in sports is a fantastic thing? I mean, I know every job has its challenges and so forth, but what's it like to work in that world?
Well, it's fun. Yes, it is sports. And I think the fun part is people can relate to it. People that I talk to, can relate to my job and, questions about it. But I can relate to kind of a fan and a fan experience a lot easier. So I think those two together are very helpful. But the organizations we work with are, very esteemed organizations and wanting to push the envelope. So it's a great place to be where you've got your clients, if you will, wanting to push innovation as strong as IBM wants to push innovation.
I love that too. Well, let's jump into that. So what are some of the trends that are impacting sports digital innovation from the data analytics world?
Well, in the world of tennis, for a number of years, there's a fair amount of data that's collected for each tennis match. And, years back, it was pretty much, the score and some statistics around it was an ace, it was an unforced error. So a combination of structured, data that is, derived right from the chair umpire and others that are more subjective, like an unforced error or a winner. And that data is informative to how a match is playing out. People would look at it kind of like an Excel spreadsheet. How many unforced errors does each player have? How many aces? And do some sort of comparative lineup. And that was informative. Then we started to use analytics against that data, much like we do in other industries. And really, we're able to do things like, we refer to it as keys to the match. So we can look at, when these two players have played one another before, based on our historical data, we've learned that when Federer is playing Nadal, if he gets a first serve percentage of greater than 40%, he tends to have a good outcome, meaning he tends to win the set. So we can kind of declare, if you will, those keys prior to the start of the match and then update them as the match is unfolding to give a fan more perspective on why Federer might be winning or why Federer might be losing. So for years, we've been using data in that context and, started to look at more data. The line calling system that is used to determine whether the ball is in or out if a player challenges, we realize that system actually runs all the time. You may only see it when somebody calls for a challenge, but it runs all the time. So we're like, if we can get the player X, Y in the ball X, Y, Z position, we can do even kind of more analysis. So we've been able to do some distance runs, more precise, analysis around depth of shots and things of that nature. So We're always looking for more data to make, you know, kind of that user experience more informative. And most recently, you know, we've started to realize and recognize the fact that video is data. For all these tournaments, their content is critical. And the more timely distribution of that content, the more unique that content, you know, the more eyeballs they can get on it. And highlights for sports are very popular pieces of content. But they're also, you know, a challenge to produce and produce at scale. So if I, you know, gave the USTA editorial team an assignment that said, I want you to create a highlight for every player of every match and have that available for distribution via push notifications, you know, 5 to 10 minutes after the match, they'd probably fall on the floor trying to think about how much staff they would need to do that. Can they do it? Sure. But if you use AI technologies, you can do it more efficiently and do it at scale. So we've leveraged our kind of Watson and AI capabilities to watch whether it's a golf shot or a tennis point and analyze that. And analyze that on a few dimensions. So one is sound. What was the reaction of the crowd? Mm-hmm. And not just the noise, but the oohs and the ahs and sort of the undulations on it. So machine learning technologies to kind of differentiate and then teaching it or training it that this is a highlight, this is not a highlight. This is more exciting, that's less exciting. And getting a perspective on it from sound. Well, what was the player, you know, reaction to the shot? You know, fist bumps, arms in the air, moments of celebration type actions. Again, training these technologies on what they are for golf and what they are for tennis. And then the emotion on the player's face. You know, was the player excited in terms of emotionally? And then the context, you know, from a data perspective. Was this a set point or match point?
Right.
In the world of tennis, or was this an ace, you know, in the world of golf? And being able to take those three dimensions and score every shot or every point in a tennis match, well, then we can, you know, very easily kind of create a playlist of shots based on the most exciting and other business rules. Like we want the, you know, video to be no longer than 3 minutes. We always want to include match point and whatever other business rules you have. And we, in essence, offer up a shot list as a recommendation to the USTA or to the Masters of, you know, shots that we think should be included in this highlight. And they can approve or disapprove. They can add or subtract very easily. Not video editors, it's a very kind of drag and drop kind of interface. And when they're content with the shot list, they can push a button that highlights generated and ready for distribution. And that happens, you know, again, 5 to 10 minutes after a match completes, you know, compared to a more robust user generated highlight by the editorial team might take, you know, an hour ish, if you will, to prepare. So it allows the USTA to get that content out much more rapidly and at a much larger scale. So we've seen that as a very impactful in the world of tennis and golf.
Well, I hadn't thought about it that way, but I can see how artificial intelligence could use the sound and the expressions to really cut up the video and get some real-time insights going, not only for the fan, but eventually for the athlete as well. It sounds like there's a lot of video involved in what you do. You got video in tennis, all the lines, of course, for whether the ball's in or out, as you said, expressions on the faces of the participants, sound going with the crowd. It's a lot of data. So how do you manage all this unstructured data?
Well, the unstructured data, you know, is first of all, there's multiple sources of this data, and probably tennis has probably the most disparate, you know, sources, because we've got structured data coming from the chair umpire system for the aces, you know, foot faults. We've got more structured data coming from courtside statisticians for those judgment calls as it relates to unforced errors and winners. We have the serve speed, which is a radar generated. We actually have weather because we've got weather, you know, on the court as well. Then you have the, you know, line calling system. And really all of this data is, you know, collected locally, but then pushed up to, you know, the IBM cloud. And that's, you know, where we're able to manage that data and able to apply whatever analytics we want, you know, to that data, house that data, where, you know, again, wherever we want. So for our Slam Tracker application, which is our real-time scoring for tennis, you know, it relies on the keys to the match analysis, which is, you know, using an SPSS type analytics. It also has pressure situations, which are things we've determined that when a player is down low 40 in a game, what's the probability, what's the likelihood they'll come back? Well, that's more, you know, using Spark. So we're able to kind of have the data in the cloud, but do all the analysis on the cloud as well. So without the cloud, it would be very difficult.
Probably impossible. Yeah, I was watching some combat sports last night, and they were showing the heart rate of the participants, and that's kind of interesting, because you're seeing how winded that they're getting, and that, you know, that really feeds into the whole fan experience as well. So there's a lot that can be
winded
participants too.
On your winded example, we're recently, working with the USTA and their player development team, who, you know, coaches, you know, watch a lot of video to help coach and train their players. Mm-hmm. They are looking and observing their player in some kind of aspects of their player's performance. And so we've been able to leverage some of the same kind of highlight technology to index video for them, so they can more quickly go in and look at all the unforced errors, all the winners, and kind of do their human analysis on and observations on that. But we're also have that line calling ball, you know, player XY position. So we've been working with them on, you know, what can we do with that data to help them from a training perspective. And one of the things they've focused us on is, it starts out as a conversation around something, or they refer to as a redirect step. So in tennis, you know, you can imagine the player in the ready position to take the serve. They move to the right to hit the shot. They move back to the middle. They move to the left to take a shot. They move back. So that move out in the deceleration to the point where they hit the ball, and then the acceleration back, there's a certain threshold there of like being able to monitor that throughout the course of the match and observe their player's kind of performance in set one versus two versus set three, and begin to set benchmarks for each player, which can then help them with a training regimen, because ultimately they're trying to turn this more into a fatigue factor, so right, they can understand, you know, their player and how fatigued they are at any point and what they need to do from a training perspective. So we're really starting really the infancy of that work, but it already is showing some promise of how we can tie it directly to player performance. And the other thing that we'll be working on are, you know, when we went down to their player development facility, you know, they had a coach come in and kind of talk to us about things that mattered. And he was talking about a Murray matchup to Djokovic. And again, he watched hours of video, and he observed that, you know, Djokovic will go cross court, cross court, cross court, and then maybe down the line. But he won't go down the line before he's had at least three cross courts. That was sort of enough information to, you know, coach Andy as it relates to, you know, being able to feel comfortable with a few shots before you have to really worry about where you are on the court. And so it's those kind of things that, you know, just the light bulb went on for us. It's like, well, that's a pattern. You know, we can look for those patterns in the data as well. So again, starting to, you know, work with the experts like the coaches and kind of leveraging the technologies to help identify some of those patterns or, you know, things that we should be able to do to help, you know, further the USTA player development efforts.
Well, that's great. And I see how you're actually involved in the actual game itself with some of the rule calling. You're involved in the production experience, and we've touched on some of the things related to the fan experience, but let's go there a little bit more. So I've observed lots of ideas about, you know, the fan experience, utilizing their cell phone, their, you know, smartphones. We all have them. We all bring them. As a matter of fact, I was at a concert the other night, and I was way in the back in the cheap seats, and I was able to see the hundreds, really, of people with their cell phones holding them up, you know, taking video of the performance. And I know it was a concert, not a sports event, but I think the same kind of dynamic plays out. So is that an integral part of the sports viewing experience in person in the future? Are we going to be more tied to our cell phones as we observe a sports event?
I don't know about tied, but certainly there'll be an opportunity to do things, because we also work with the Mercedes-Benz Stadium and the Falcons. and, you know, have built apps for really that in-stadium, you know, kind of going to the event. So there's everything from wayfinding, how do you get from point A to point B? How do I navigate to my seat? I'm in my seat. I want to order a hot dog. I can do that. So those kinds of things, as well as watch a replay, you know, which is one of the things where, you know, the sports, and I know specifically the NFL, they're sort of sometimes their biggest competitor to getting somebody in the seat is your, you know, 60-inch HD or 4K now TV. And, you know, with fantasy football being so popular, you know, you're, to some degree, you're stuck watching a single game and how it plays out. So they're cognizant of that and trying to balance a fan experience with, they want you to be watching the action on the field. They don't want your face buried in the phone. But right. The same breath, you do have your phone. Those social share things are great for everybody because it, you know, it's a sort of a show-off moment for you as an individual, like, look where I am. But it's also a great thing for the Falcons in that particular case because, you know, people are then exposed to, you know, more about the Falcons. So it's sort of win-win. But I think it's at least for a lot of organizations about balancing that, if you're in stadium, if you will, making it a utility for somebody, but not sort of distracting from the action that's right in front of them.
Right. That's pretty delicate balance there that we're trying to have when we go. I know the temptation's always, no matter whether I'm at a sports event or somewhere else, temptation's always to be looking at your phone. And that does, you know, can tend to take away from the in-person experience. As we go forward, though, we've seen a lot of evolution, revolution, really, in how we watch sports, not only in person, but on the television. So 5-10 years from now, what's going to be different about watching sports, viewing sports, is both in person and from the remote perspective? I want to say television, but I know it's not all going to be television in the future.
Well, I think from my vantage point, what I see kind of starting, and it's early, but I see it trending, and it's kind of to your point of may not all be television. I think these organizations are looking at things not so much as that's TV content, that's digital content. They're starting to look at these things as that's their content. So the way they tell the story of tennis or the way they tell the story of golf, you know, I think is going to become to some degree more unified and to a large degree more personalized. So, you know, today, you know, watching a golf tournament or watching a tennis tournament, you know, you're largely restricted to what the broadcast decides they want to show you. And early on in the tennis, you know, there's 18 courts of action going on. And, you know, you may want to watch because, you know, it's your favorite player or it's your brother or whatever, you know, whoever's playing on one of those out of courts. Well, I see a future where you'll be able to do that. You'll be able to pick that and you'll be able to watch that for as long as short of you want. And so I really think it's that kind of personalization of the experience will be one of the biggest trends that we'll see over time.
Okay. Well, I look forward to that. Now, you talked earlier about fantasy football a little bit, and as you mentioned, millions of Americans are participating in this. And can you tell us a little bit about the Watson involvement with fantasy football?
Sure. Well, about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, we met with ESPN, and they have a very solid presence in fantasy football. I mean, there are other products out there, but they have a very solid presence. And they were looking for ways to enhance their tool. They do a very good job, you know, kind of putting a tool together that, you know, has your team, able to manage your team, look at information about your player, and they give you a projection for what they think the player is going to achieve this week, give you a bunch of articles to look at, and then you make a decision what player or players you want to start this week. We're like, well, we can maybe enhance that because Watson and AI technologies have the ability to read or understand a plethora of information. So we have a utility called Watson Discovery that is connected to about 100,000 sites. So able to kind of look at those 100,000 sites, you know, some 300,000 articles, and we've trained on football. So we've trained the fact that, the different teams. So Bills are a football team and Patriots are a football team. And so all that kind of terminology, so that this you can go out and read those 100,000 sites and the articles and then narrow it down to a conversation about player and then analyze that conversation at the level of sentiment. So one aspect is we give you kind of sentiment of, you know, what are people saying about, you know, Tom Brady? Is it positive? Is it neutral? Is it negative? And again, just a little bit of perspective on, you know, maybe how people are feeling. But we've gone a bigger step and probably more important step is we've taken that and we've correlated that sentiment to the performance on the field. So we've trained it, you know, from a couple of years of football data of correlating the sentiment to, you know, what the actual achievement of points are on the field. So once we did that, we're able to say, so, you know, you shared your football team with me. So it's like Tom Brady is projected, at least from ESPN perspective, to get, you know, 18.7 points. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, with the ability to kind of read all the information about Tom Brady, correlate the sentiment to performance on the field based on history, you know, we know that he's got a 20%, you know, chance to boom, to do, you know, kind of more than 22 points and a 17% chance to bust. So we give the fantasy owner a little bit more perspective, kind of the potential upside, the potential downside. So as you're looking to start two players and you have Russell Wilson, mm-hmm. So Russell Wilson's got 17.9 points. Tom Brady is 18.7. So, you know, you'd probably start Tom just based on that. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the numbers, it's kind of reaffirmed because Wilson has a 25% chance to bust. So you're kind of looking at like small differential on the points, more likelihood to bust. I'm going to go more conservative and pick Tom Brady. You know, in your running back situation, you know, on the surface, if you just went by raw numbers, who has the most points, you'd pick your Duke Johnson and Dalvin Cook. But if you look at your team a little bit more and looked at Sony Michel, while he's projected to have kind of 1 point less than Dalvin Cook, he's got a 25% chance to boom or score greater than 18 points. So it's like a consideration that you might say, you know what, I might swap that out and take a little risk there. So it's giving the team owner kind of that more information to make a more informed decision.
I see. So if I was playing a team that was top of the league, scoring 100 points a game, I would have to take some more risks if I wanted to possibly compete with that and just lay it out there and see if maybe some of these players win boom, which would be what I would need really to beat something like that.
Exactly. And, you know, the corollary to businesses, I mean, this is a business kind of decision tool to help you understand a risk reward here. You know, there's an upside and a downside to it. So just how conservative or how, you know, risky. And to your point, yes, if you're looking to make up some ground, you might be willing to take more risk. If you're sitting at the top of the league, then you're probably just looking to sit at the top of the league. So there's no need to take that unnecessary risk.
Well, it's fascinating what technology can do today for things like this. I remember when I first started playing fantasy football probably 18 years ago that we would submit our lineup and the poor commissioner, fortunately it wasn't me, when he'd get the paper on Monday morning, he would go through the box scores and assign our scores and inevitably be wrong about a few of them. And we wouldn't really know till midweek, you know, if we won last week or not. But you're talking about scanning 100,000 articles or 300,000 articles and 100,000 sources and whatnot, you know, like as if it was nothing and pulling out all this sentiment. So things have come a long way and sounds like, you know, you for not only the tennis and but also the fantasy football, also the golf that you talked about, you need to have trust in the technology and in the data that you're using. So help me out there. Is the trust there? Can we believe a lot of the analytics that are going to come out of these experiences?
We believe so. And the reason is, you know, first in terms of the data for, you know, the structured data, we have a lot of checkpoints in place to check and double check the data and, you know, deem it the official source. So that's very important. you know, when you get into the world of, you know, kind of the AI and the machine learning models, you know, we are, you know, looking to remove bias and as much as possible within, you know, within those algorithms. And that, you know, is by, you know, kind of being more transparent, you know, with the way the articles and the sentiment in this particular case is calculated. So, you know, we are trying to make it not not black box, but, you know, being more transparent with and trying to eliminate any bias. And that's something that, you know, we'll continue to focus on. And as a company, it's a priority.
Well, I get that. Great. And in my corporate world, trust in that data is very important as well. So thank you, John, for all your insights today and the insights on my fantasy football team, my underperforming fantasy football team. Thank you to all our listeners for tuning in to another episode of Data Decoded. You can learn more about IBM Unified Governance and Integration at ibm.co/UGI. You can find this podcast and more at ibmbigdatahub.com. Have a great day.